Exawave.
L'histoire de l'art, l'anthropologie, la question et la réflexe de la philosophie.
Hexagramme.
Des chercheurs en art, médias, science, design et technologie s'adjoignent.
Nunc vivere inter vietenim, fuscest, vivamus attellus, fellentesque habitant morbi triste malesua da fames.
Cette émission nous permettra d'entendre les propos de l'artiste Jason Lewis. Jason Lewis, professeur à l'Université Concordia et chercheur actif dans le réseau international Hexagramme. Il est directeur du groupe de recherche d'OBX Labs, qu'il a d'ailleurs cofondé, et dont le travail consiste à réaliser des projets en art numérique avec différentes communautés autochtones. Il est également co-directeur d'APTEC, Aboriginal Territories in Cyberspace, un réseau constitué d'artistes, de concepteurs technologiques et d'universitaires qui proposent des espaces et territoires virtuels aborigènes sur le web, dans les jeux en ligne et dans les environnements virtuels. Il pratique également l'écriture et la poésie qu'il destine aux nouveaux médias en créant des formes graphiques de textualité à travers la réalisation d'applis et de différents logiciels qu'il développe avec son équipe. Il a dirigé aussi des workshops dans les écoles avec des étudiants sur la culture autochtone et les jeux vidéo, leur apprenant comment les créer et les structurer tout en faisant usage de différentes techniques narratives. L'objectif principal, pour que de jeunes autochtones puissent créer des univers dans lesquels ils sont représentés et leur donner les outils pour qu'ils puissent continuer ces activités au-delà de l'atelier. Ainsi, ces jeunes qui ont parfois l'impression qu'ils doivent choisir entre leur culture traditionnelle et la modernité technique peuvent imaginer et décliner des représentations du peuple autochtone se déployant dans le futur. À travers ces productions artistiques, les objets techniques et les pratiques culturelles traditionnelles sont revisités à la lumière de développements évolutifs pour les générations futures. Notre entretien avec Jason Lewis commence avec quelques commentaires à propos de l'un de ses projets qui s'inscrit justement dans cette démarche. Time Traveler TM, réalisé par Skawenati.
Time Traveler TM, which is written and directed by Skawenati. This was a project telling the story of a young Mohawk man from the 22nd century who sort of travels through time. He doesn't really travel through time. He uses this technology that is very much like the holodeck on Star Trek, where he puts on these glasses and it recreates scenes of historical. This recreates scenes of historical events, and so he uses this technology to travel back in time and visit events that are important to First Nations people in North America and Mexico, Central America, and as well as to visit events that are part of his past but part of our future, right? So it's a way, it was both a way for Skawenati to revisit the past but also to sort of dream and think about what our futures might be.
Going back to skins, what is different in those video games that Indigenous youth are creating compared to just the other ones?
So the main thing is the content. So the way that we run the workshops is, so the technical component of the workshop is the same as any video game workshop. You know, there, and you can find hundreds of them now, right? So that is not particularly special. What's special is that in the course of teaching them the production skills, we bring in storytellers from the community and elders and mentors who tell stories from the community and talk about why the stories are important, talk about what makes a good story, things like that. So that when they get to the point where we've given them sort of the basic technical instruction and they have to sort of figure out what is the game going to be, like what is the story going to be in the game, you know, their heads have been filled with, you know, 50 hours or so of, you know, of the characters and the places and the scenes from their history, right? And so they then use that to construct a game, a narrative around which to build an interactive experience and build a game-like sort of experience. So that's the big thing. So, you know, you look at the games and, you know, the first three games were set in the past and dealing with, you know, characters from specifically Ganawagi sort of lore and legend. So it's the characters are native. It's everything, all the material culture that you see is based on Iroquois material culture. the big bads that you're fighting against are come from those legends, you know, so the stone giant and things like that. And then there's also some Mohawk language in there. Not a lot. We would like there to be more going forward, but there is some in there. And then the fourth game that we built with the kids, that one's set actually in the present day, but it's about a woman coming back from finishing her PhD and coming back to the reserve and sort of discovering that there's been some nefarious doings going on with somebody stealing wampum belts from the community. And so she sets about sort of tracking this person down and saving the wampum belts and so forth. So it's all about sort of locating it in the native culture. But, you know, the workshops had two, I mean, the primary purpose of the workshop was the training. And not just the training, but making a connection, hopefully, with the participants that there isn't there doesn't have to be a division between sort of their history and their traditions and the modern day, right? The fact that they, you know, the fact that they play video games and they make video games, right, doesn't mean that they can't also be traditional, because oftentimes it's sort of presented that, you know, tradition is this thing that sort of happened in the past and we sort of take on in the present, but it's not something that is evolving now. Right. So we're like, you know, what you're doing is you're always, you know, the communities are always in the process of evolving their traditions. But sometimes the message that gets sent is that traditions are sort of sacred. And so they can't evolve. Right. They can't be touched. And certainly from the outside culture, that's a huge message that's sent. Right. People in North America. And well, not North America. I mean, I would say the Europeans have this even worse. Right. So they have this idea that to be native is to be from the past, right? People have a very hard time seeing native people as contemporary actors in a modern society, and that message is received very clearly by the youth as well, right? And sort of like something that they absorb. And so part of the project is about saying, look, you know, this isn't a choice. You don't have to make a choice between those things, right? If you're making video games and playing video games, it doesn't mean you're not native, right? It doesn't mean that you can't also engage with your traditions even as you're making those video games. In fact, you should, because that's what you know, right? And you know, you can make games that don't refer to that, but you know, it's a source of inspiration and illumination that can be used to design and create all sorts of things, and certainly video games is one of those things.
And does it seem to work? Like what's their reaction as they're experiencing the video game for the first time and then reflecting on it?
Well, it seems to work fairly well. I mean, the reception is hard to judge in certain ways. What was really interesting to watch is when we did the very first workshop, you know, so we did the storytelling, we did the basic construction, everything like that. And the first one was actually over a year. We would go out to the reserve every week, and then once a month we'd spend 2 days out there and do intensives. And about halfway through in January, February, we had to take a break for some reason I can't remember. So we said, okay, so, you know, we've done the storytelling. You know how, you know, what a game is and what's necessary to make it, stuff like that. Now you guys got to figure out what you're going to do. And you know, when we went away, Scavonati and I were talking, we were like, we really weren't sure that what we'd come back to. Like, we thought there was a high possibility that we'd come back and they'd still be like, well, you know, we kind of like this, we kind of like this. But we came back and they had laid out, four of these tables here with butcher paper and designed an entire game on it, like where it started, where the mountains were, where the river was, where that big bad was, you know, how you went from one to the other, what the challenges were. They totally remediated it, right? They totally remediated the things from the stories that they had been told and the storytelling they had participated in, and they had figured out how to put that into a game-like form. And seeing that happen, and then that's happened consistently, right? It was very clear that, you know, there's a basic thing of like, oh, I can make a video game, right? Like, I don't, like, you know, I don't have to play, I just have to play them. I can make these things. So there's that. And then there's the other thing where you can see happening where, yes, where they're like, oh, okay, this is, you know, I can own, you know, I can own this story, right? This story is part of me and part of my parents and my grandparents and my elders and maybe even part of the longhouse and things like that. And, you know, so this is something that I, you know, I believe in and I'm really excited to see in playable form. Right. I'm really excited to see in a way that I can interact and I can actually, you know, the stone giant. I've been hearing stories about the stone giant my whole year. And now, you know, we went and we made one and now I can see it, you know, and that's amazing. And then I can have the character interact with it. So there's something about like bringing the culture to life in a particular way that does seem very effective and very powerful. And, you know, and then they're very proud of these games. You know, they give them to all their friends and, you know, and talk about the fact that they made them and are very excited about that. So
it is quite impressive because it goes just the fact of integrating the indigenous culture to this digital world is something. But also, as you said, it's also a matter of identity, just teaching those kids that. All crossovers and mixtures are possible as long as they feel good with it. So
yeah.
That's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And that brings us, maybe I'll just make a bridge to the Initiative for Indigenous Future.
So the Initiative for Indigenous Future grew out of all that work. One of the things that we saw, you know, in talking, you know, because we spent a lot of time with these students. We spent 200 hours, right, with these students. And, you know, one of the things that we saw is, you know, most of us who were running the workshops were science fiction fans, and there's a close, you know, there's lots of fun science fiction going on in video games, and so it's sort of a natural topic of conversation. And one of the things we noticed is that, you know, these youth didn't necessarily, they didn't see themselves, you know, in these scenarios 100 years from now or 500 years from now, right? First of all, almost none of these games have indigenous characters in them. So there's just that sort of literal, like they didn't see themselves, but also that, you know, it wasn't clear that they even saw kind of their communities as being part of these future worlds that were being painted, right? And, you know, we thought that's a really problematic thing, right? I mean, it's problematic on the individual level if, you know, the community that you're part of, if you don't feel perhaps that the community you're part of is going to survive for the next 200 years, right? It's problematic from the perspective of the majority culture, right? And so if what we think of as the future imaginary of the majority culture doesn't include your people, that's a really dangerous place to be, right? Because they don't have to think about, if you're not going to be around in a couple hundred years, why do we have to worry about what you want now or what you need now? And also, we know we see the future science fiction and the future imaginary as a just an incredibly huge palette on which to paint dreams, right? And it's a really good way to think about how things might be changed in the present in order to help get to whatever that future might be. So we built you know, starting with the Aboriginal Territories and Cyberspace Research Network, we built a partnership three universities and six or seven community organizations that are interested in working with us on sort of both trying to understand this idea of the future imaginary, sort of understand what the indigenous future imaginary might be. So going and looking at, there are people within the indigenous community who do, you know, dream of and talk about the future like that. So understanding what's going on there, but then populate that future imaginary. So undertake various projects to help sketch out different ideas about what might be happening in the future, you know, what the seventh generation might actually be like, or what the 20th generation might actually be like. So we're going to continue doing the Skins workshops as part of that, because part of all of that, of course, is continuing to create a technical base so that people can make the future. Right, so we're going to keep doing those, though we're going to branch out beyond video games and so forth. But we're starting a residency series. So the idea is to get one artist in every year and basically be like, you know, you're here. The only constraint is that you need to do work that envisions you, your community, or some indigenous community, you know, seven generations from now or further out. right? We want to push people out. We don't want people, mm-hmm. you know, the next 10 years or so, that's too close. There's people already doing that in lots of different ways, right? We want to push it out. But then we're also going to invite two non-artists because we live in a bit of an art bubble. Mm-hmm. And so we want, and there's people who are not artists who are doing really interesting work trying to think about the future of indigenous sovereignty, legal orders, sustainability, food sovereignty issues, you know, health, all those sorts of things. And so we want to bring those people in, and the same constraint is, you know, we want you to imagine whatever your domain is, whatever your expertise is, we want you to imagine what the implications are for that, you know, seven generations from now, for either your particular community or the Canadian Native community or North American, whatever, you know, that's a, or even over, you know, the Maori or Aboriginal or Ganaki Maoli, Native Hawaiian population, so we can sort of get those conversations going as well. And then we're going to do a symposium every year about it, and then we're going to we're archiving Indigenous new media artwork. What was really interesting about the initiative for future for Indigenous Future, forgot my own title there, was that when we were putting together the partnership, we had built up a reputation like within the larger community, so that when we went to communities where we knew people, but we, you know, there were new communities that we were trying to bring on board, like they already knew about the workshops, right? And also, you know, we haven't done a workshop in 2 years because various things, you know, we're constantly getting requests from people, from parents usually, who are like, my boy or my girl would really like to do this. When is the next one going to be? And stuff like that. And so we went around to people and we're talking about the initiative. There's clearly been a groundwork laid of people were predisposed to hear us out, you know, and these are, you know, Native communities, you know, there's a long history of people, particularly from academia. So even though Scott Wanati, for instance, is from Ganawage Mohawk community, and that I'm Cherokee and Hawaiian, right? You know, I'm still an academic. It's still funded through academic research, right? There's a long history of abuse of, you know, people, academics sort of parachuting into communities and taking what they need and then leaving and never give anything back to the community. So people, you know, are very, I think, justifiably skeptical of anything like this. But because of the work we had been doing with the youth, and also a lot of people know about Time Traveler TM, Scott Wanati's project. They show it in their schools, they show it in their cultural centers and things like that. You know, people were, you know, they were interested to hear what we had to say. And when we started talking about this idea of the future imaginary, that was really amazing, because my concern, I think, going into it was, you know, there are really serious problems in the present, you know, and challenges, and that people would be resistant to the idea of sort of spending time and resources on dreaming, you know. And, you know, what we found was that, oh my God, I'm going to tear up, is that people were incredibly hungry for the opportunity, actually, to sit down and think, you know, let's just dream about what our grandchildren are going to be like, instead of being so worried about, you know, what's happening and what might happen to them. And I think I'm tired or something. I don't know why.
Well, yeah.
So that was really, really heartening, you know, and the elders were like, you know, we had several comments from elders that were basically along the lines of like, you know, if we're not dreaming the future, what's the point, right? This is exactly the sort of thing that we should be doing, and, you know, people were enthusiastic and supportive of it, you know. So I think all of those things kind of, you know, make us feel like we're going in the right direction, right? And that the work that we're doing, you know, not just with the youth, which in some ways is an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's an easy sell, right? Everybody wants to help the youth, right? But, you know, the work on, you know, imagining, you know, with adults and professionals, you know, people in other places. And I did a public talk in May. And for that talk in Toronto, it was a Walrus talk. I commissioned seven Indigenous artists to imagine. He was like, basically, it was like, look, here's some money, and, you know, just create a picture for us what you think your community is going to be like in the future. And that was amazing. We got seven of those, and also those artists, you know, about half of those artists said something very similar. Right? They said, like, you know, thank you for giving me this context, right, to do this, right, to free myself up from the, you know, these are people, a lot of, you know, there's people who, a lot of them are actually working with youth themselves, right, and they understand the challenges of working, you know, that facing our youth these days, you know, and so they felt that it was a really great opportunity to, yeah, to do something that I think people want to do, but they feel a certain responsibility to the present, mm-hmm. and to be engaged with what's happening in the present and not fly off.
I'm interested to know, for how long have you been working on these indigenous issues? This is not your first work about it, right?
No. So, for me, you know, my story is very complicated. I was adopted by a white family, born and raised in Northern California, and was not raised in my culture. Didn't really encounter it until I went off to university. I went to Stanford University as an undergraduate, which has a very strong Native American community. And then sort of like started on that journey, ended up as the chairperson of the Stanford American Indian Organization and stuff like that. But then when I got out of university, I maintained the personal ties and the community ties, but my work wasn't focused around that for many years. Really until I started going to the Banff New Media Center, New Media Institute in the 90s, because Banff had the New Media Institute, which, you know, I'm assuming you all know about. But they also have a very strong Aboriginal arts program. And so it was one of the few places, if not maybe the only place in the world, where you would find a significant population of Native artists and creators with a significant population of people working in like digital media. And Sarah Diamond, the director of the BNMI for most of that time, anyways, you know, she did a really good job of like pulling, you know, those of us some from the Native community into the digital media stuff and bringing the digital media stuff over to the Aboriginal stuff, and so that's where I started getting engaged more with that. And Scavenati invited me to be a co-curator for Cyber Powwow and version of that, and then it just sort of took off from there. So, but the big thing was that Shirk, we couldn't find money actually to do what we wanted to do for a while because it was so community based. But then Shirk in 2004 started an Aboriginal research envelope, and that's what gave us our first leg up, and that's what funded the first workshops and everything else like that. And so now that's just been able to build, in no small part because Shirk has gotten smarter about funding Aboriginal things, research, and also because they've also gotten smarter, and the universities, I think, have gotten smarter about supporting community-based work. So we're recognizing it as research.
It is actually, it's touching to see you so engaged, and dreaming about the future is also a way of providing hope. And when you were talking about it and the way you were talking about it, I saw a link to also the other work that you're doing, maybe poetry.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to poetry, and how does that influence your body of research?
Well, I got to poetry because poetry was my first art form. So I was writing poetry as a love-struck, you know, teenager and so forth. But I wrote fairly consistently for years and years and years. And I love language. And actually, part of the reason why I got into computer science was actually because of language, because sort of looking at it as a writing practice. And so when I went off to design school, I, you know, had to propose a project, and I was like, you know, I'm going to make like the ultimate multimedia poetry writing tool, because at that time, you know, it was hard to like bring images and sound and make the text move and things like that. And so I didn't end up doing that, but what I ended up doing was producing a series of poems, interactive poems, and sort of in the process, sort of developing, I don't know if I'd call it a theory as much so much as a personal position on interactivity, and the idea that you know, where we wanted to go with interactivity was sort of looking at it as a semantic function, right? Where, you know, at the time it was also new and everything, and mainly it was seen as a, you know, either sort of instrumental function, like interactivity helped you do something, or as a navigational function, right? So it helped you get from one place to another. And there wasn't a lot of interactive, there wasn't a lot of interactive art, period, but there wasn't a lot of it that I felt actually brought semantics into the interaction. There was a lot of what I would consider basically essentially interactive sort of demos masquerading in this interactive art. I actually still think that's the case. So working with poetry provided me with a language to articulate that, because poetry structure is very important, and it's also much more explicit than in prose. And there's language, well-developed languages for both, but I was familiar with the language for talking about structure and poetry. I just started thinking about, so what are the equivalents? So in the interactive world, what's the equivalent of rhythm and rhyme? What's the equivalent of spacing between words or using punctuation? What is the equivalent for oral poetry of affect in the voice? You know, how do we not necessarily how we translate, in fact, not how we translate, that's part of it, but how do we look at what the computer can do and figure out what it's really good at doing that we couldn't do before, right? Not that we leave those other things behind, but, you know, what for me, it was like, what is the point of slapping a poem up on the screen and calling that digital poetry, right? I'd much rather read in a book anyways, you know? And so it was really about pushing this idea of, you know, if you're gonna move it, then you're gonna have, then you need to mean it, right? There needs to be a reason why the text is in motion. There needs to be a reason why you can poke and prod the text and it does something. And so that became kind of the central theme of all that work, is really trying to think about, yeah, what is the meaning of the interactivity that I'm asking people to engage in with the poem, and how does that augment what the poem is about? And trying to get to a point where, in the same way that you wouldn't consider E. Cummings poetry without reading it, right? It's challenging. It's challenging to just hear it because you don't get the structure of some of those poems, or the way it's laid out on the page. And then there's also a whole history of concrete poetry and things like that. So my goal always was to produce work where the text component, the visual component, so the design, and the interactive component were all so deeply integrated that you couldn't pull one or the other of them out without doing serious damage to the text. And by text, I mean the big, the whole thing, right? Not just the words. And that's why I'm very happy with the Poetry for Excitable Mobile Media project, the Poem Project, is I feel like finally, I got to a point where I was able to pull all those things together and do it in a way where I felt like I was writing poetry, like, by doing all of them together, right? So in this, like, they're all eight pieces are very different. And it is as they should be, because they are different poems. Yeah.
So, as you said, poems comprises eight pieces.
Yes.
So from what I understand, it's the poem and the structure of the poem that dictates the digital experience and how you're kind of going to.
Well, at the beginning, yes. That's how it was at the beginning. But by the time we were working on the last three, I would say, everything was being developed together, right? And so, probably the first three or four, they would start out with some snippets of text, some lines that I'd written, and then I'd start thinking about, I'd be like, oh, okay, this one is actually, there's something about this that I want to activate, right? Because I like write lots of poetry, and most of it I'm like, this is good, just like it is. And then sort of working forward from there, and both by myself, but with my long-term collaborator on the project, Bruno Nadeau, and then we sort of come, we'd get something pulled together. But by the end of it, it was very much, sometimes I'd sit down and I'd start sketching a piece of functionality in using code, right? And sometimes I'd write something, and sometimes I'd actually start with a font. I'd start with a visual element, right? I'd be like, wow, that's a really interesting, powerful font. And it sort of has a particular personality, and that would draw me in, and so that I would sort of obsess with it for a while. And then text would start coming from that, or I'd pull in text from some other things I'd written. And then the interactivity would come with that, or Bruno would come in, you know, with amazing sort of ideas for the interaction, you know, that would support that sort of stuff.
I guess that would be worth actually directing your listeners to the website of Poem, which is poemm.net, because there are examples of each of these eight pieces in action. And as you said, it's very different. Sometimes you've got a line with text moving. Sometimes you've got things that almost look like mitzvahs in French, like, I don't know, lively water creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can really see that creating very specific, as you said. So it's not even the poem influencing the creation anymore. It's completely a dialogue.
Yeah, it's coming together, and they start off their lives as large scale, say 50-inch touchscreen pieces for exhibition, and then we move them to iOS. So seven of the eight are free to download at poem.net. And then the eighth one is a limited edition. We're only going to sell 100 of them, and that one we charged $9.99 for. So we tried to charge $999 for it and only sell 10, but Apple wouldn't let us.
Yeah. Why a limited edition?
That was a probe into using the App Store as kind of a way of selling art, right? And also just sort of part of the more general conversation of how do you sell digital art. Right, you know, all the questions of reproducibility and maintainability and all those sorts of things, and so it was something I was very interested in at the time, and I still am, and we were just like, well, let's see if we can use this venue to sell limited editions, right? And then how do we do that? And then we actually had to figure out a novel way of programming in the edition number, right? So that the edition number is attached to your iTunes account. So if you upgrade your phone or you change phones or whatever it is, or you get a new iPad or whatever, you can still download the app, and which you can because you bought it, but it has your edition number in it. So if you bought edition number one, that will be edition number one no matter how many times you download it onto your device, right? And so there was the sort of that aspect of like, how do we do it functionally? And then there was the social kind of engineering aspect of it, which is like, how do you tell people about it? Like, how do you convince people to buy it? You know, and then there's the, what I don't know, I guess I'd call the political economy of it, which is dealing with the App Store, you know, which said, you know, and they were like, they actually called me up, which never happens for like a little single developer. You know, they called me up and they said, we want to talk to you about this. And like, why are you doing it that? And we don't think we can let you do that, man. And they're like, you know, we're very concerned that people who are paying that much money, that they get a lot of functionality out of their apps. And, you know, and so we had this whole conversation about the fact that it wasn't about functionality, right? And that value is not just about functionality. Value is about the experience you get out of something, the pleasure you get out of something, the history of something, right? The whole sort of like, it was like, art and commerce 101, you know, and it was just one person, right? It's just the dude who was like reviewing apps that day, right? And it was fun and it was really interesting. And I was very happy because he was, you know, I talked to him for over an hour, I think, you know, and, you know, at the end of it, he was like, you know, I'll take it up and I'll see if maybe we can make this happen. You know, unfortunately, called back in 2 weeks and said they just said, no, you can't do it. You know, we don't want people, basically what they don't is they want people, they'd just been burned recently about the, I forgot the name of it now. There's an app. Oh, the I'm Rich app, right? Which was for $999. You download it, and what does it do? It opens up. There's a picture that comes up of a guy. I think it's a guy. It basically just says, I'm rich. That's it.
Oh.
Okay. And so, you know, there's a couple people who bought that and just, I guess, had enough money or enough of a sense of humor. They just were like, they kind of laughed. But there were, you know, there were a couple people who complained and they made a big stink about it. And so they're in this mode of like, you know, if it doesn't like help you calculate your bank account or something like that, then, you know, we don't think we can let it through. You know,
take the responsibility.
Yeah. So, you know, and you know, it's funny because as much as, you know, Steve Jobs would talk about the importance of art, you know, as well as a liberal education and things like that, Apple doesn't give a shit about art, right? They do not, you know, and that essentially that's what I was told. They were like, well, we're not in the business of selling art. And I was like, I know, but you are in the business of selling apps that people make, You know, and I was like, if I sell these for $999, you get $333 from each one of those, right? But they, didn't fit within their worldview. Yeah.
So it's actually quite impressing how far it can go, starting from digital poetry to getting in the
getting into the real business.
Yeah.
Well, Jason Lewis, that's pretty much all the time we had for today. But thank you very much for this very interesting talk, going from art to the digital world to dreaming to indigenous future and poetry. Best of luck with your project.
Thank you very much. This was a pleasure. Thank you both.
Merci.